Welcome to our Big Blend radio show here with Mike Guardia, who's a military historian and author of numerous books. He talks about Julia Compton Moore today. And so today's show is on his Big Blend Radio Military Monday show with Mike Guardia channel, on our Way Back When History channel, and on our brand new Women Making History channel. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome to Big Blend Radio's Military Monday show with Mike Guardia, award-winning author and historian. Welcome, everybody. You know, it is March, and March is a Women's History Month. And so today we're going to be talking about a very special lady, Julia Moore. Julia Compton Moore, actually, is her first name. And Julia was born in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, back on February 10th, 1929. We're going to be talking about her relationship with her husband, Hal Moore, and the legacy and work that she did for women who were married to men that served in various wars. So we're going to, of course, have Mike Guardia here. Mike, how are you?
Hey, Lisa, I'm doing very well. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
Hey, we're excited. You know, we do this show with you every first Monday of the month. And so March, I was like, dude, we got to do something on Julia Compton Moore. And so, you know, I didn't realize, and, you know, let me just back up here, everyone. Mike has written a couple books, three books, right? Focusing on Hal Moore. So we're going to start with the biography, Hal Moore, A Soldier Once and Always, and that chronicles the life of Lieutenant General Harold G. Moore. And then, you know, the movie, We Were Soldiers, that starred Mel Gibson. That's kind of, is that how you knew about Hal Moore?
Yeah, you know, the first introduction that I had to Hal and Julie was that 2002 film that came out. I had the privilege to see it on opening night. And, you know, I had heard in passing about the Battle of Ai Drang, but I never got in depth into any of the key players, both on the battlefield and also on the home front. And, you know, just seeing that film and just the incredible impact that Hal and Julie had as a military couple really inspired me to want to learn more about the both of them. And yeah, it was just it's been a fascinating ride ever since.
And we got to go to his museum, which was amazing, because I remember Nancy going, we're on Hal Moore Parkway in Bardstown, Kentucky. Yeah. You got to call Mike now. You're like, pull over, go to the museum, you know. It was just one of those things where, oh yeah, we're here. We didn't even like dawn on us until we were literally in front of the museum. Yeah. But you've got three books. So the other one is Hal Moore on Leadership, Winning When Outgunned and Outnumbered. And this is a book that you wrote with him, right? And then also took his principles and do speaking engagements, right? And it's, it was a finalist in the 2018 International Book Awards.
Mm-hmm. It sure was.
Do you still do those talks? I know you teach, but do you still go out and talk about leadership through Hal Moore's work?
Not as much as I used to. I really just let the book do its own talking. You know, I know that it's been included in several leadership courses. It's become a regular book that's part of the course texts in leadership courses at both the Air Force Academy and West Point. And I know that it's been featured on a number of blogs. It was featured on Jocko Willink's podcast. So I think the book as part of an ongoing leadership seminar, for any number of venues, you know, that have hosted it. Yeah, I think that really drives home a lot of the big main points. The last speaking engagement that I did for it was, I just want to say it was about a year and a half ago now. And it was at the headquarters of the 7th Infantry Division at Fort Lewis. And, that is by every strand, the big target audience for the book and those who I think really stand the most to benefit from it, because much of it was written from the warfighter's perspective.
So you've got the leadership, the warfighter, right? And that I think is I want to get into the third book too, and then your
Yeah.
latest book, Fire in the Hole, that's kicking butt on Amazon, right? You're like a bestseller with it right now in Vietnam War history, right? Which is pretty big. I think that's pretty big because it's, you're telling the stories from, again, the fighters' position, the actual people, the combat heroes, right? People on the ground, the combat engineers. And I think Hal Moore was like that. Look, he really cared about the people beyond the uniform and
Right,
what
he
he
really
did.
did. He really
Yeah.
did. You know, and that was really one of the things that spurned me on to write the book Fire in the Hole. You know, I wanted to put something out there that was told from the soldier's eye view, and you know, those who were pretty much at ground zero, your Johnny on the spot trigger pullers who were really making things happen. Because I mean, without them, you don't have a war effort at the ground level. And also, you know, to tell it from the perspective of a branch of combat arms that really doesn't get, I think, as much press as it normally does, or as it normally should.
And one of the last times we talked about Hal Moore was when Fort Benning became Fort Moore. And we're going to talk about Hal Moore's wife, but she's actually part of the name Fort Moore. It's for Hal Moore and her, right?
Yes.
Wow, that's cool. How often does that happen?
Right. Yeah. It's, you know what? I think that's the first time that anyone has proactively named a spouse as part of the legacy behind the namesake. And I can say with, you know, I mean, I can say with every bit of sincerity that, that they as a couple earned it, because so much of what Julie Moore did as a military spouse really paved the way for a lot of the army program, or a lot of the army family programs that we have today. And I don't think the army's family network would be a shadow of what it is today without a lot of the legwork that Julie Moore put in, you know, 40 and 50 years ago.
Let's back up a little bit. You've got the three books. The third one is Hal Moore, and you look at his life in pictures, right? A life
Right.
in pictures. You have photos. And did you get a
Yeah.
lot of that from his family and
I
from
did. I
him?
did. I did
Wow.
a lot of the initial photos that I got were when I was interviewing Hal Moore for the first biography. You know, I pretty much had unrestricted access to his entire photo archive there, and I was scanning a lot of pictures of what would eventually go into the biography. And as I was compiling a lot of those photos and trying to figure out which ones would go into the book, and you know, also leaving it to the publisher's discretion of which ones would make the final cut, at some point down the line, I got an idea. This is right after I finished the leadership book. I said to myself, you know what? There's probably a market, and there's probably, I would say, a need to continue the story in terms of a photographic essay, because they say a picture is worth a thousand words, where there are so many great photo ops and so many great images that have been captured by Hal Moore and his family over the years that not just illustrate the depth of his military career and his commitment and his accomplishments, but also just give very valuable insight into the man himself. And you know, what made Hal Moore tick, what his values were, what his core driving principles were. And I said, you know, if I could put this into a photo album of sorts, just a published life in pictures, you know, kind of a you know, it's comparable to a coffee table book, but not quite. I said, I think that it would, you know, I think it would resonate a lot with those who are inspired by Hal Moore, just like I am. And yeah.
That's huge. Because I look at it this way that, Nancy and I travel the country doing parks, public lands, and also a lot of museums. Museums now, you've got to think about how we now have been documenting history for centuries, right?
Right.
And so museums are at this point where things have to be digitized. And we remember back when in microfiche days, I don't know if you've had to do that, right?
Oh
With your
yeah.
research on things.
Yeah. Good old microfilm.
And so there's this, but at the same time, a museum only has so much space to showcase. And, you know, sometimes it's a special, like, here's Hal Moore's life. It would be like a rotating exhibit kind of thing. And I think what you've done is make it very accessible to people around the world by putting it in a book, you know, so people can get the, you know, the paperback or hard copy, or also digitally. And I think that's something we need to look at in regards to history, is that the books are our next museum, and it's something we can access all the time, you know, whether it's from our phone, a tablet, or, you know, the actual physical book. Physical books are always better, personally. But don't you feel that, like, that in a way that you kind of, it's a museum piece?
I do.
Yeah.
And I think on a subconscious level, that's also what motivated me to present it in the way that I did. You know, I said, hey, there's any number of good museums you can go to that are going to have exhibits like this. And if you go to the one in Bardstown, especially, it's a virtual treasure trove of things that celebrate Bardstown's favorite son, so to speak. And
Yeah.
I just wanted it. I wanted to make it accessible for all of those out there who would never get a chance to see that museum or might not otherwise have a chance to learn as much about the man. And in a broader sense, it's really what motivated me to do those books on the F-14 and the F-15, because
Really?
because I went looking for a one-stop combat history of the F-14, and I couldn't find one. You know, there were several fragmented volumes out there, and a lot of the most comprehensive books out there on the subject were long since out of print, published by publishers who had long since gone out of business. And they were fetching like $250, $300 on Amazon or eBay just because those editions are that rare. And I'm
Wow.
like, well, you know, I don't want any aviation enthusiast and veteran like myself who wants to get access to this to be put out and only get fragmented parts of the information, and usually at these cutthroat prices.
Right.
And so I'm like, okay, well, I can write a book myself on it, compiling everything that I've learned, any existing interviews that are out there. And that's that really was the genesis for the books on the F-14, F-15, and especially the MiG-25, since it's very hard to find any comprehensive published book out there that's not, upwards of like $500 or whatnot.
Right, because don't you also, if you've served and you've been in aircraft or used certain artillery ammunition, or have even been to certain camps or bases, right, or fought in certain regions, don't you want that connection later or even during? You want some kind of connection to the history of the then so you can connect it to the now in a way,
Of
you
course.
know? Yeah, and I think. I love those books. I had no clue. You know, Nancy and I had no clue. Like, you know, hey, I got these books. We're like, all right, we're going to talk about fighter jets. But holy cow, you talked about the people in them. You talked, I had no idea about these jets being sold to this country. And the next thing you know, it lands back here again, like this full circle moment. And now I'm just, it has opened our eyes, you know, and minds. And here we are. You know, women who've never been in the military. We're not, you know, we're not Julia Moore by a long shot. You know, now she's a woman married to Hal Moore, and I want to get into her story so much, because she, you talk about these couples, like these military couples, right? There's a strength. They say always, behind every great man is a great woman. Now I hear Annie Lennox singing in the back of my head. But anyway, they really were a power couple, but it wasn't, I hate that term actually, power couple, because it's so, I don't think they would like it actually in my mind. It's like a, I think they cared, you know, power, sometimes the word power, maybe it's just right now, the political climate, power just sounds so gross right now. You know, instead of, yeah, care. I feel like they cared. He cared about the soldiers he not only led, but fought side by side with. and rescued. She was, in a way, in a different war with the wives, of wondering what was happening to their husbands, keeping morale up, raising families during all of this during Vietnam, right? Did their legacy start in Korea or Vietnam? Like, where do we should, yeah, it really did start in the Korean War, right? With him. I want to kind of back up where they first met and what they went through together, their beginnings.
Yeah, so their beginnings actually started a little bit before the Korean War. If we wind the clocks back to 1948, so this is going to be right when Hal Moore comes back to the United States from his duty in occupied Japan. So he spends the first 3 years of his time on active duty with the Army of Occupation in Hokkaido, Japan. Learns as much as he can about the Japanese culture. He's there on occupation duty, very proud paratrooper. And it's time for him to rotate back home. He lands at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Well, what was then called Fort Bragg. That's the home of the 82nd Airborne Division and pretty much the de facto home of the Airborne Corps itself. He is at first assigned to the 82nd, but he has what can only be described as a very much administrative role, because this is, I mean, even though we're 3 years out from World War II, it is still very much the post-war army. There's really not a lot of training going on, and most of what he is doing is escorting the remains of dead soldiers who had been temporarily buried in Europe, and now they're being reinterred stateside to be closer to their families, their surviving families in Georgia and the Carolinas and whatnot. And so for a few months, probably the better part of a year, he's doing that, and he decides, well, you know what, it's important for me to escort the remains of my fallen comrades, but it's taken a little bit of a toll on my psyche. I want to do a little bit more than just be a well be And I'm not even sure that this is the right term, but it's the only one that I can think of right now. It doesn't want to be a Johnny on the spot funeral director or a hearse tender, I guess. And just because after a while, it does weigh on your soul. And so one day by chance, he comes across this advertisement that is soliciting volunteers for an experimental parachute program. The Army Field Forces has this testing and evaluating program where they're testing experimental parachutes for the Army, Air Force, and the CIA. And these include a number of both low altitude and high altitude insertions. And he says, wow, okay, that really sounds like a blast. I think I want to do that. And while he is in the midst of airborne evaluation section, that's when by chance he comes across the young Julia Compton. Was at a It was at one of the local pools, either on Fort Bragg itself or in the greater Fayetteville area. And they pretty much hit it off right away. And then he learns that her father is Colonel Compton, who is a very distinguished artilleryman and who had fought in the European theater of World War II. And the very strong courtship between the two of them, blossoms. And by the following November, that's November of 1949, they get married. And th there's a there's a very humorous anecdote that is a footnote in the that is a footnote in the leadership. Oh, no, excuse me. It's a footnote in the Life and Pictures book, and it tells the story of Colonel Compton supposedly locking himself down in the basement on purpose, no less, and trying to drown his sorrows with a bottle of Jack Daniels because he is none too thrilled that his daughter has married an infantryman. And those who don't know, there's a very healthy rivalry between the infantry and the artillery that goes back for several centuries. That is the popular anecdote that is associated with that wedding. But despite the despite the initial reluctance to have his daughter marry an infantryman, and him trying to ease the trying to ease the pain, drown his sorrows with a bottle of Jack, he very quickly accepts Hal Moore as his own son, and the two had an amazing relationship for the rest of Colonel Compton's life.
Post hangover. It's like,
Yeah,
here,
of
I'm
course.
walking you down the aisle with my head hanging down, right? Yeah. Yeah.
I
But
says,
you know, but
yeah.
it, but I think her childhood, because she was even born on a fort, you know, at a fort, not on a fort, at Fort Sill in Oklahoma. So she really knew and was raised. She was a brat, right? You know, so she really was raised in this world. So if anyone's going to understand it as a wife, she already had it, you know. And because as far as what I've learned over the years and reading your books, Mike, and going to the museum, seeing even Hal Moore's house, which is not far from the museum, it's so humble. It's not, you know, I think he was that. I think he never lost sight of where he his roots of who he was as a person, like from childhood to, you know, adulthood and striving for something. He kept, yeah, I don't know, he just seemed to keep his principles and integrity. I think we've used that word with him before, integrity. You know, and I think she had that. And then, you know, just they kept that. They, you know, we talk power couple again, using that term, but I don't, that's why I don't feel like they're like that. I think power couple now we're looking at Beyonce and Jay-Z or something, and it's just a different picture. I'm not knocking anybody at all, but I'm just saying it's unglamorous. They were not this, that's what it is. That they were just really good people doing the right thing with integrity, without the glamour. They weren't, they didn't care about the glitz, it didn't feel like. I mean, doesn't mean that she didn't want to get dolled up or, you know, he's not going to shine his medals. It, you know what I mean? It didn't matter about the glitz and the glamour with them. Yeah, which is nice. So they get married and her life is still a brat in a way, right? When they get married, and she traveled the world with him,
She
really.
did. She
Yeah.
really did. She traveled the world. Let's see, gosh, all over the continental US, and then to his duty station in Korea when he did his tour along the DMZ there. And just on the various vacations that they had in a number of exotic places, not the least of which was the Taj Mahal. They had been so many different places, and made friends at almost every step of the way.
And with them going around the world, let's talk about her connection with the women. How she bonded with them and realized something has to be done. Let's talk about that role, because I think even it was well portrayed in the movie, I think, with her.
It was.
Yeah, tell everybody about what she did for women, and she got in there. You know, she was a mom too during everything. You know, that's important to note too, that she was also a mom. But tell everybody a little bit about her role as what she did for women, for the spouses of the men in at war.
Well, it's a long-standing tradition in the army, at least the army that I came up in, and for I think as far back as at least Vietnam or World War II, that when you have someone take command of a big unit, be it a well, I'll say from a company level all the way up through battalion, brigade, and even for a division, whoever the commander is, their spouse is, for better or for worse, a partner in command. And the spouse has a great sway and a great influence over the morale of the unit, particularly in how he or she interacts with all of the other spouses. So it's generally understood that, let's say, in Hal Moore's case, that when a man comes to take command of an army unit, a battalion, that his wife will become the de facto leader of all the other wives in the battalion. That's the wives of the company commanders. That's going to be the wives of all of the lieutenants, all of the NCOs, and even all the way down to and including some of the lower enlisted who might also be married. And that really becomes a support network in and of itself, where they form a lot of babysitting co-ops. They do a lot of they do a lot of what are called family events. They do a lot of fundraisers. They do a lot of cookouts. They do a lot of bake sales. Really, they are what keeps the home front together whenever the soldiers are either out in the field or whether they're on deployment. So having a good spouse who makes good inroads with all of the other officer spouses and the enlisted spouses really does go a long way. And it can make or break the morale of any unit, particularly in a time of war. And what Julie Moore did, was just head and shoulders, I think, beyond what most military wives were doing at the time. And she really played that forward into a lot of the support mechanisms that army families have today. So what she did is she gathered up all the wives and she said, "Okay, well, I'm Julie Moore. This is who I am. I'd like to know a little bit about you and what we can do to help each other out. Where can we find the best deals on clothes? What can we do to get to the PX? How can we help each other out? What are our comparative schedules so we can watch after each other's children or get together for a ladies' night out or whatever? Or how can we organize birthday parties?" It was really a mom's network that had a very good spirit of keeping things sane on the home front. Now, where she went above and beyond really was, when all of the soldiers deployed, she really took it upon herself to keep all of the women very in a very tight-knit organization, to where they had constant contact, constant communication with each other. She could recall instantly birthdays, anniversaries, everything else like that, and really trying to comfort a lot of the women who were having to make do without their husbands there, and become a source of intense emotional support when she now had war widows in her midst. And the way that she fought for them and the way that she advocated for them was just nothing short of miraculous, and really nothing short, in my opinion, of warranting sainthood. Because when the casualty list started growing, the army didn't have enough chaplains and casualty assistance teams to go out and support all these war widows, so they were delivering the death notice telegrams via yellow cab. So she said, "That's unacceptable. Tell the cab company to give me the telegrams. I will deliver them personally, and I will render all the support that I need to for them." And then she would just raise hell with any number of the base commanders, any number of congressional leaders, even when she didn't think that army families were getting a fair shake at something. And when she was with Hal, when he took command of Fort Ord out in California, she helped lay the foundations for what would eventually become the Army Readiness Program. And she organized it so that there was a one stop for all of the families to exchange things like baby goods, to exchange information on childcare, and really just made the Army Post itself a support network for Army families. And in doing that, she really laid the foundations for the Army readiness, the Army family readiness system that we know and love today. Every single unit has one, and it runs deep within the it really runs deep within the roots of the organization, that that know that if you're a soldier and you're here, that you have, and even if you're a single soldier without a family, you have a network that is here to emotionally support you.
It I think this is something that we all need to understand what a military family goes through. And, you know, I know from when we lived in 29 Palms what, you know, the other side of the family was going through, especially at that time, you know, Desert Storm, you know, all of that. You know, there were so many tours. Like, wouldn't that happen with, you know, a soldier going back out, coming back home for like, here, you get to do laundry after 5 years kind of thing. And then, oh, now you're gone again. Like, it was really difficult on the families. And I think she understood that, right? And so was she a help for women who had no clue about the military system? I was thinking about that with her, how, you know, it was great for her and Hal because they spoke the same language, you know, and I think, well, she was really ingrained in it, I think even more than him in her childhood, you know. And for maybe a young lady marrying a soldier, not having a clue about the military, what a whirlwind is it for them? Suddenly your life has changed. You may be going international. It's just a different protocol, even.
Right.
I mean, you know, you're on our shows all the time teaching Nancy and I, well, no, this is not how it is, girls, you know, kind of thing. So for new wives and new husbands now too, in this era, if you're not familiar with how the military works, it's got to be kind of a shock in a way, like a culture shock in a way. You know, when you go to a new country, that's always a culture shock. You go through that. And I think going in, being in the military lifestyle suddenly can be a little difficult.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I think she did a lot for women that way, right?
Yeah, she
in
did.
Helping them.
It was really a godsend for a lot of those women because you know, you had some of these spouses who they were with their young officer or their young enlisted husbands, and it really was the first tour for that spouse, and they didn't quite know what to expect. And then almost as soon as they arrive at Fort Benning, now they're suddenly whisked away to fight in Vietnam, a war that it's not terribly unpopular yet, but the mission parameters are ill-defined, and it's not going to go as smoothly as a lot of people think it is. So, you know, just that big unknown and trying to grapple with the realities of military life, it helps to know that you have someone you can talk to and someone who is coming from the latter day perspective of a military spouse who say, you know, hey, once upon a time, I was in your shoes. I was a clueless spouse, you know, didn't really know what to expect or which way was up or what the Army's expectations were even. And so you have an advocate here for me. Oh, and by the way, know that I'm here to address any emotional support needs that you might have.
That's really huge. I mean, when you think about it too, like if someone goes through an illness, you know, and you want somebody who's going through it or has been through it to communicate with, because they can tell you something straight up or make it funny or not, you know what I mean? Versus someone who hasn't been there, you know, then the person who's not been there doesn't know how to communicate. It's kind of the same thing. I'm not saying military is an illness, but it's a serious life thing. It's a life change, you know, and it's a commitment for the whole family and the kids. So was she able to help with the kids too through this and help the moms, you know, in that family unit, help the kids understand what their lifestyle was like?
Oh, of
as
course.
brats too.
Yeah, because she had five children of her own. And
that's a lot of kids.
Yeah,
Dang.
And at least one of those children fell within the range of age groups that all of the other kids were. So it's like, oh, hey, well, you know, I have my son Greg, and here's my other son Steve, and here's little Davey, and here's Cecile, and here's little Julie, and they can play with your kids, and they can show them the ropes, and you know, tell them anything and everything about you know, about what it's like to be an Army brat, including, you know, where the best places to hang out on post.
Yeah. Okay, so on post, that's something too, right? For
Mm-hmm.
people to think about. It's like the military has its own city,
Yeah.
right? So that's the other thing. So how does that work actually? Just for us civilians to know, because some, like when we were in 29 Palms, there were families living off base and there were people living on base, and then there was military housing. How does
Yeah.
that all divide up? What, who gets what and where and why?
Okay. Well, typically, if you are a service member and you are assigned to any one post, depending on what the post policies are, you're almost guaranteed to be eligible for on-base housing. So, by way of example, I can tell you this. I can tell you when I was at Fort Knox, if you were a single officer, male or female, unmarried, and you wanted on-post housing, they had a spot for you. So there were now, if you were a single officer, okay, so if you were a single enlisted, you would live in what are called the barracks. And single enlisted barracks go from private E1 all the way up to about a staff sergeant, E6. So if you fall into one of those junior enlisted categories, you live in the barracks, which are pretty much like your modern day apartment buildings. They have all of the typical amenities that you would see there. It's a it can be like a 10 by 20 studio, or it could be like a it could be like a small one bedroom suite or whatnot. But those are comparable to your modern day apartment complexes. Now, those are termed barracks, okay? Now, if you are a single officer, male or female, between the ranks of second lieutenant to about a captain or major, you can live in what's called the bachelor officer quarters. And depending on the post, that can either be a much bigger apartment complex, or it can be a single unit housing that are comparable to townhomes. They're pretty much all connected. You have provisions for that. And if you are a single officer above the grade of major, up to and including lieutenant colonel, colonel general, you have single unit housing, that's standalone housing, that's on base housing. And that's what the command billets are typically identified as. You'll have like a battalion commander. Even if the battalion commander is not married, he's going to get his own standalone house, and it could be a one story, it could be a two story, anywhere from 1500 to about 2500 square feet. And if you're the command, if you're the post commander, you're generally going to live on a special part of the base that's called Commander's Row, and it's going to be all the nicest houses that are on that base. Typically it's period architecture, and then the base commander is going to have this is going to have this very nice house that could pretty much be a mansion unto itself. Typically anywhere from 3,500 to 4,000 square feet, and it's going to be easily the nicest house on post. It's going to, be identified by the flags in the front, the flag that has the number of stars according to the flag officer's rank. Like if he's a three-star general, it's going to have 3 stars on it. So those that's your on-base housing.
And
Now,
you don't get drunk as a soldier and go knock on his door in the middle of the
right.
night.
Yeah,
Don't do
because then you're going to meet the pavement real fast.
Okay, you don't do that, right?
So those are the options for on-base housing. Now, you also have the option to live off-post if you want to. And if you do that, the Army will give you what's called BAH. It's called Basic Allowance for Housing. And depending on where you live, each state and each metro region has its own assigned number for Basic Allowance for Housing. So let's say that I was a soldier and I wanted to live not on Fort Bliss, but I wanted to live out in the economy on El Paso. Then I would fill out a form that says, "Hi, my name is Lieutenant so and so or Captain so and so, and I want to live off post, and I need a basic allowance for housing in order to cover that. So that would be money that's thrown onto my regular annual salary as a soldier. And because I've been identified as living in the El Paso area, the Department of Defense calculates, okay, what's the average rent or average property tax for homes in the El Paso area? And they say, okay, congratulations, Lieutenant so-and-so. In addition to your monthly pay, you will get an additional $1,200 every month that you can use to offset the cost of housing, whether you want to buy a home that you're paying property taxes on or whether or not you want to rent a home.
And whatever, and if you go above that, that's your deal. You have to pay for that. So how much did Tom Cruise pay for that house in Top Gun in Oceanside, California? I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. But that's the truth, right? So because the military can do, yeah, you can do that. So like if you have a wife who's a, I'm not living on base, that's it, right? Then you can appease doing like, okay, we're going to go out here. So they work with you. Do they work with you internationally? Because I was thinking about that with Julia and, Julia Moore, keeping her in mind of this conversation, during, Vietnam and everything, where were they living at that time? And if, because they traveled the world literally, right? And in Asia, and I know so many military families, and a lot of times they'll say, oh, we were on base or off base. And I always wondered about that. I was like, well, how did you do that? But it can happen that way internationally, right? As they were living,
Now in today's army, even if a unit deploys overseas, all the family that's home and they're living on the base, they get to stay on the base. Now, back in the mid 60s at Fort Benning anyway, if the unit deployed overseas, the spouses had to vacate the on-post housing, which was just so incredibly dumb.
Wow.
So I was like,
Are
what was
you
the army
kidding
thinking?
me? Yeah.
So that was just infuriating. Now on the overseas posting, like, I mean, like some of the overseas bases that we have in Germany and also in South Korea, it's a little bit different a standard there, because typically what you have is you have these small little bases that are networked together. So most of the families who end up in Germany, or the ones who end up in Korea, they live on the economy anyway. They'll like they'll take they'll rent these homes in the German countryside, or they'll rent the second floor of a German apartment or whatever. And the BAH that they get to live is calculated according to whatever the local currency is, and the market trends of what the typical rates are.
Just wild when you think about this, about being kicked off base. Like, what if you have ki that's kind of weird. So
It is.
did Julia go through any of that where she had to move? Because,
Oh, of course. Yep. And
wow.
it did not matter that she was a colonel's wife. Didn't matter that, her husband was a battalion commander. No, the only thing that mattered was that okay, the unit's overseas, so you ladies, you all got to clear out of these homes. And a lot of them moved into these bungalows and these trailer parks out in out in the town outside of Fort Benning, Columbus. And they were just living in these
This is
squat.
in Georgia. This is Georgia, right?
Oh
Cl Cl Columbus, Georgia. I've been there. Yeah. Wow.
It's incredible. And for lack of a better term, it really was just infuriating, because they were living in these squalid conditions. And
Yeah.
to add insult to injury, you have a yellow cab that's going to deliver this casualty notification. And you're just like, it's like, we're already down. Do you really want to kick us while we're down?
Right. And did substance abuse happen to these women? Did you think through it? I wonder about that.
If it did, and I'm almost dead certain that it did. If it did, I didn't hear about it, but I'm sure that a lot of these women, because, well, a lot of these women were already smokers. I mean, this was the early 60s. So I think a lot of them took to more tobacco use, and certainly it's not beyond the realm of possibility that they would also turn to
Drink.
alcohol to ease the pain.
Yeah.
Illicit drugs, I don't know if those were truly a thing within the ranks yet, but
Yeah.
you fast forward just 5 more years to get to the end of the 1960s, and yeah, all of these illegal substances are run rampant through the barracks. So I'm sure that in some form or fashion, they made itself into the military families.
It's wild, man. When you think about it, like, so this is, I'm so glad we're having this conversation because I don't think we get to hear the other side of the story, what the women go through, you know? Julia Compton, didn't she get an award for her work for the Army families? I think it's the Julia Compton Moore Award I'm reading about. It's through the Ben Franklin Global Forum. Oh no, that's the press release. But she got like an important award for what she did.
She did. She was awarded, and then now there's an award that also carries her namesake. Just for as important as being a military spouse is, it really does warrant a reward for those who do an exceptional job in keeping those in keeping all those army families together. They say, and this is more than just an amusing anecdote. They say that being a military spouse is actually the toughest job in the military, and based on everything I've seen with my own two eyes, everything I've read, I can tell you that that is 110% true. I mean, yes, the people in uniform do an incredible job. I know that we veterans, we can all look back and say, yeah, I mean, it was a tough line of work to be in. It was tough, but it was rewarding. But at the same time, we have to say, it is an incredible drain for those who have to hold down the home front. Yeah, and as a matter of fact, one of my fellow veterans was telling me not too long ago, said, Mike, I look back on our time in the service, and I actually think it's a lifestyle that's better spent alone. And all things considered, I really couldn't argue that point. I really couldn't, because
I had a friend who served in Camp Pendleton, and he went through a lot, and in through Desert Storm and everything, and he was in our band, our music band, and we went to his house on Camp Pendleton. And they had a really nice house. Mike, he said he was a gun sergeant, but he had a really nice house in Camp Pendleton. So I don't know what that means. But his wife lost it pretty much. So much stress, so much strain. And I don't really know. Like we always said he was the CIA. Like we always joked about him because he would disappear and then come back, and it was, I mean, when you were talking about the housing, I'm like, I don't think Eddie was a gun sergeant. I think he was way more, and he had traveled the world, and very intelligent human being, very kind soul, amazing human, just amazing. I miss him. And but I remember we went to his, I think it was his 40th or 50th birthday party at his house. 40th. Yeah, he wasn't. Yeah. Oh my gosh, now I'm really feeling old. But yeah, it was his 40th, and it was bad. Stuff went down, and it was a very emotional evening. And his wife was not handling things very well and having a very hard time because she also was. It was a battle between her being her own person too, you know? I'm not speaking ill of anybody here. It was a very traumatic, tumultuous time. And I don't think our band should have been there at that event, but it was a party for him, and he had just gone through back surgery, and next thing you know, he was on the ground, and it was a very traumatic night. And I know he's fine with me talking about this. It was, when I realized that the women are suffering. And people would look down on her. You know, people didn't understand her, but like she was in pain, like emotionally in pain, because her husband was there and then not there. You know what I mean? And I don't know what he was really doing in the military. I don't to this day. And I always think there's something more about him. You know what I mean? I can't even explain it, but do gun sergeants have really fancy houses on Camp Pendleton?
Well, let's see. He's a gunnery sergeant. That makes him an E7. He would be, he would have housing comparable to, I think, a captain. So if he's a married sergeant with dependents, yeah, that would he'd be
Okay.
in yeah he'd be in housing comparable to a captain. Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, she was having a hard time. And I wonder about where we are now, from where what Julia started, how we are now in women supporting women, maybe. She was having a hard time because her husband wasn't home. And then he would go off and do music and do things that he cared about too. Didn't mean he didn't care about his family, but I think she wanted her husband. You know what I mean? And he wasn't that he had many interests, let's put it that way. Not in women or anything, but in that way. And it was just a very eye-opening place to be, to understand what women go through raising kids on their own. And she felt very alone. And it is sad. It was really sad. And I wonder about that for women on bases and maybe not understanding what they're getting into, like what you were saying. Like not understanding. It was a glimpse of a night of one thing that happened, you know, for them. And it was a glimpse. And I think that sometimes women don't know what they're getting into, you know, or men marrying into a military family situation. Like how your life is going to change, right? Wouldn't you say for people getting into it? It's going to be more than just your life, right? As a couple, and for the kids that come too. And but there's a lot of lessons that are positive too, right? For everybody involved, wouldn't you say? For kids, they learn discipline, and there's some positive, you know. And I think Julia did a lot to soften those blows, you know. And yeah, I wish Eddie's wife had that a little bit more of a support, you know. And I don't know where to go with that. Are there women, are there support groups depending? I mean, so that was Oceanside, so that Camp Pendleton's Marines, right? Yeah. So are there groups within the military now? Like I know she, you know, Julia Compton did it for Army Wives, but are there like spouse support groups on bases throughout, no matter whether it's, you know, Army or Marines, Navy?
Well, yeah, I mean, there's a comparable family readiness organization throughout each branch of the armed forces. And yeah, they're and yeah, they all have pretty much an identical mission, to provide as much support for the families and the spouses as they can. And apart from that, you also have a very long-standing network of private organizations, private charities that exist for the very function of stepping in, where any number of the family readiness groups are unable to. And yeah, it makes for a and most of those organizations were started by former military spouses. So
Oh yeah. See, they understand that. That's going back to someone who's done that, walked that road, you know. Going back to Julia Moore again, she was in the movie, and so we want to talk about that. We Were Soldiers. She was portrayed by Madeline Stowe. Madeline Stowe is she's amazing actor, by
She
the
is.
way. I think she's great. And she did an awesome job in that because she's got that serious face too, right? Serious and kind, and don't mess with her. Strong, a strong woman, and dignified too. Very dignified and graceful. Like she showed you could be a graceful, strong woman, and you could wear a dress and still be strong. I think there's something to that, honestly, because even in my era of growing up, it was like if you had to wear pants or whatever to be strong, but that's not true. And I think Julia Moore showed that too as a woman. But I saw in the museum in Bardstown that she was part of the movie, like her and Hal, right? They kind of were, did they like walk them through it and were like consultants on the film?
Yeah, they were. So Hal especially, he served as a technical advisor on the film. He was on location for so much of the filming, and just provided his inputs wherever he could to make sure that it was as accurate of a representation as he could provide, and as one that adequately reflected the realities of life in that unit.
Okay, so she's part of that. So everyone, you've got to watch the movie, but also read the books. But I didn't realize that Helmore died on her birthday, right?
He did.
That's weird. I mean, like not weird, but like synchronicity-wise, like
It's cosmically ironic.
Well, you put it better than you're the writer. But it's to me that just kind of goes like those two were like soulmates. It feels like you meet couples that that those two are always going to be together. I feel that about them. I've never met him. You got to meet her, right?
No, actually, Julie passed
Oh.
away before I could meet her.
Oh wow. Yeah. Would you have liked to have met her? Right. I
Oh,
would.
goodness, I most certainly would have.
I know it would be just so like, okay, I'll just sit here and be quiet. tell me how to be, because she just seems like this pillar of strength and just such a strong soul. So, I mean, him passing away on her birthday, yeah, that's kind of a, do you think they were soulmates?
Oh, yeah, there is
Yeah.
no doubt in my mind.
Yeah, I think they give hope to people. And as a team, and I think they represented a team. Yeah, that's a good word instead of power couple. Team, power team. Yeah, I like it. Well, thank you for giving us some insight into Julia Compton Moore. Everyone, you've got to go get Mike's books and learn more about Hal Moore. I know you've got Julia in the photo book, right? You've got her in
Oh, I
there
do.
and in the books. You couldn't write about Hal Moore without her in everything, right? But right now, the latest book from Mike is Fire in the Hole, Tales of Combat with the 1st Engineer Battalion in Vietnam. So how many books of Vietnam and the Korean War have you written? Like how many, you're in the 20s now with your books, right? Every time I'm wrong. So, but like you've done a lot on Vietnam and you think about it in the Korean War and yeah, you've done a lot. You kind of know that war, don't you? Like, yeah. I mean, how many books do you think? When you think about it, of all the generals? Huh.
just
Yeah.
just of
Yeah,
the
the
just of the Vietnam War.
yeah, that's insane. Like when I think about it, you've done so much of yeah, I mean, you've got a lot because you touch on so many, like even when you get into, the different, fighter jets and everything, you'll touch on things. So it's yeah, you've covered it quite a bit. What's next? For you, now that Fire in the Hole is a bestseller, like you need to outdo yourself again.
I have quite a few irons in the fire, but one of them that I'll share is one about the spy war in Bosnia back in the mid-90s, and I think the book buying audience will be pleased with that one. At least I hope they
Alrighty.
will.
Oh, they will. They will. Well, thank you so much, Mike. Everyone, MikeGuardia.com is a website. He is on the show every first Monday. It's our Military Monday show. We love it. Mike always teaches Nancy and I, and I know our audience enjoys him. He always teaches us something new, gives us things to think about, and also an appreciation for military life and those who serve. So thank you so much, Mike.
All righty. Thank you. Always a pleasure to be on the show.
Thank you for listening to Big Blend Radio's Military Monday show featuring Mike Guardia, award-winning author and historian. Keep up with Mike and his books at mikeguardia.com. Follow us at bigblendradio.com.